So welcome all of you. Thank you for coming here today afternoon. Honored to be here and the Lotus Feet of Radha Madhava. And I'll speak today on the topic of understanding the triangularity of our desires. Desires are what drive all of us. In fact, they don't just drive us, often our desires define us. When, say, somebody is a young student with a career in front of them, often when they meet each other or someone does meet them, what do you want to do in life? What is your desire? So our desires, they define who we are, they define who we become. Now, quite often, we are very careful in choosing the things that we have around us. Okay, I want to buy this kind of phone. I want to have this kind of house around me. I want to have this kind of clothes I want to wear. But while doing all this, I seek your blessing so that I can speak something. So, then we choose the things around us quite carefully. Put a lot of thought. If I want to purchase a new house, what kind of house should I have? If I want to have a new dress, okay, what is the latest fashion? What suits me? We put a lot of thought in choosing our things. At the same time, actually what defines our happiness is not just the things outside us. It's also the thoughts inside us that define our happiness. Now there is to some extent a correlation between the thoughts inside and the things outside. But that correlation is not just linear. Now, some people, they can have a lot of things. And others, when they see these people with a lot of things, so somebody might be living in a small house, maybe a little financially challenged, and somebody is living in a big house. Externally, oh, this person is in a big house, must be so happy. But that may not necessarily be the case. There may be people who have a lot of things, but despite having the comforts, they may be comfortably miserable. They may be comfortably miserable. What does that mean, comfortably miserable? That means if a person has a lot of comforts in their lives, but if their thoughts are agitated, if they are internally dissatisfied with something, then no matter how much they have externally, they'll not be satisfied internally. So, naturally, the thoughts lead us to certain things. Things produce certain thoughts. But it's not necessarily true that improving the things outside will actually improve the thoughts inside. Getting better thoughts, things outside may not necessarily increase our happiness inside. Now, when we get better things outside, they do provide us some happiness, some pleasure. I just came from America yesterday. So in America, a month or so ago, the latest version of the iPhone was released. So people are still infatuated. Oh, the new iPhone. Now, when you get a new version of a phone, there is some pleasure, some thrill of having the latest gadget with us. But then, after some time, the sheen, the charm of it just disappears, and then it's just another object that we are using. The newness, which is the charm of things, that newness doesn't last for long. It just disappears after some time. Oscar Wilde said that that fashion is a form of ugliness so intolerable that you have to change it every 6 months.
So, normally we think of fashionable as beautiful, as good, as attractive, and it is attractive. But the same thing that is attractive initially when it is in fashion, the same thing after a few months, it goes out of fashion. And then the same thing which attracted adoring eyes, you have the latest fashion. That same thing attracts a crowd. You're so old fashioned. And the same thing is beautiful, it doesn't no longer remains beautiful, it often becomes ugly. And so intolerably ugly that I just have to give it up and take something new.
It's 3:15.
So when we work on getting things outside, we put in a lot of effort in that. But as far as selecting our thoughts inside, we are often quite lax about it. Now, the Bhagavad Gita offers us a three-level model of the self. The Bhagavad Gita explains that actually we are not just the body. There's the body, there's the mind, and there's the soul. So our existence is three-dimensional, body, mind, and soul. And this can be understood by comparing with a computer system. In the computer system, there is the hardware, there is the software, and there is the user. So the hardware is like the body. The software is like the mind. And the soul is like the user. Now, suppose my computer has a software problem. Maybe there's some virus inside it. If I go to some computer expert and the computer expert misdiagnoses the problem and tells me, actually you need to get a new CPU for your computer. You need to get a new processor for your computer. You need to get a better RAM for your computer. Or you need to replace the battery. Now, each of these are expensive. I can do that and the hardware aspect of my computer may become better by that. But that is not going to solve the current problem in the computer. So, just as a software problem can't be rectified by changing the hardware, a software problem has to be addressed at the level of the software. Some problems may be interconnected. But software problem, there's a virus in the computer. Now I have to work to remove the virus. So, similarly, just as software problems cannot be solved by improving the hardware, so our thoughts cannot be improved by changing the things around us. Changing the things around us may improve our thoughts temporarily. Yeah, I got a new phone. I feel so good about this. But after the newness of the phone fades, then again, the same old thing. So even if I say replace a hard disk, but if the virus is somewhere else in my computer, I get a new hard disk and the virus comes in again into that hard disk. And then it gets corrupted once again. So like that, dissatisfaction is caused not so much by the things that we don't have, it is more caused by the thoughts that we do have. Dissatisfaction is caused by the kind of thoughts that we have. Whatever situation we are in, we always have a choice to look at what we have or to look at what we don't have. In any situation that I am in, I can choose where my focus is. To give an example, say after this program there is going to be prasad, there is going to be food, and assume that this is going to be a feast, but it's going to be a special feast where everybody is going to get distinct items. No. Your plate is going to be different from my plate, is going to be different from his plate. Everyone is going to have different items in their plate. Suppose everybody has got delicacies, nice foodstuffs in their plates. But if instead of looking at my plate, I look, oh, she's got that, And I just look at what everyone else has and I end up feeling disgusted. Although I have delicacies in my own plate, but if I am looking at what others have, I will not be satisfied. In the Bhagavad Gita, in the 17th chapter, 16th verse, Krishna talks about Manah prasad saumyatva maunam atma manigraha bhava samshuddhi etat tapo manasa muchyate. Tapo manasa is austerity of the mind. What is the austerity of the mind? He says that first thing he says Manah prasad saumyatva. Manah prasad means satisfaction. So satisfaction is an austerity of the mind. That means that Prabhupada, writes in the purport that the more we think of sense objects, the more we become dissatisfied. If we turn our thoughts towards Krishna, if we turn our thoughts towards the scriptures that talk about Krishna, we will become satisfied. So often we think of satisfaction just as emotion. We say, I'm not feeling satisfied. Or I'm feeling satisfied. So satisfaction is not just an emotion that happens to us. Satisfaction is also a decision that we make. So if I have a feast in my plate, and if I start looking at what all who else has, I will become dissatisfied. But if I say, okay, I want a feast in my plate, just let me savor the feast that I have. And as I taste the delicacy, as I enjoy it, I will become satisfied. So satisfaction is not just an emotion that comes upon us. Satisfaction is also a decision that we can choose to make. And depending on the kind of thinking patterns that we have developed, the thought patterns that we have developed, now we will either, in any situation that we are in, we will look at the things that we don't have and become dissatisfied, or we look at the things that we do have and feel satisfied. And this, which one we will do? Whether I look at all the things that I don't have or I look at the thing that I have, that will be determined by our thought patterns. So, going back to the software example, in any computer, in a software, there are often default settings. Suppose there's a particular browser that is set as default for my computer. And as soon as I click that link, automatically that browser opens. I don't choose that browser opens automatically because it's set as default. So like that, for various aspects, there are default settings in a machine. So the default settings are a part of the software program. So some of us, so we have the default setting of looking at the things we don't have. That's our default setting. And when that happens, whatever we have, we are not satisfied with that. We always feel dissatisfied. And in fact, the whole advertising industry, it actually specializes in showing us all the things we don't have. So internally, we have that setting. We look at what all we don't have. And externally, there's a world which also shows us, hey, get this, get that. See, advertising industry, at one sense, it is telling us, okay, this is a new product, take it. But the indirect message is, you know, what you have is not good enough. And if what I have is not good enough, the subtext of it is that I am not good enough. And that way, we become psychologically manipulated into often buying things which we don't even need. It's because we think these will make me feel good. Now sometimes some people feel, actually, no, it's only when I look at what I don't have, I'll have some ambition. I'll achieve something in my life. You know, if I just become satisfied with whatever I have, what will be the drive left in my life? Now, where will my ambition come from? Satisfaction and ambition don't have to be contradictory. This is where our choosing our desires comes into the picture. We all want to achieve certain things in our life. And that's what we are meant to do. Now, we have been given God, we have God-given abilities, we have resources, and we are meant to use them constructively. So, there are certain desires that are central to us, which really are at our core, they are our core aspirations, what I want to do in my life, what I would like to contribute in my life. But along with these core desires, there are many superficial desires. These superficial desires are injected into us by the external world or by the random thoughts of my mind, of the mind. So, to understand the difference between this, between our central desires and the superficial desires that crowd us. Suppose I visit a I go on a computer and I open the browser because I want to read something particular. Say, I come to the United Kingdom, so I want to know a little bit about the United Kingdom. I came for the first time. So I go on some encyclopedia and I try to read that. Now while reading that, my purpose was to read that particular page. But then while reading that page, there's some other link, there may be a dozen other links which come up. Maybe. Now, if it's important for me, if that information is for something which I need, I can click on that link and read that. But if just out of queue, if without any interest, just based on without any real need, if I just click on something else and then I go here and go there and go there and I waste a lot of time. There is something which is involving my purpose. I came here to read one particular thing, but say some pop-up window comes up. Why don't you read this? Why don't you read that? And then sometimes instead of maybe spending 5 minutes, we plan, okay, I'll read it for 5 minutes. Several hours go away. Okay, what do I do? This especially happens if somebody is looking at pictures or watching new videos. Now one video is there, but after that there are 5 other suggested videos which come up. One after another, it just goes on. And then surfing on the internet becomes suffering on the internet. You spend hours, oh, what did I do like that? Now, internet addiction is an increasing problem. People just can't leave. To go here, go there, go there, go there. So here what has happened, I had a purpose and I wanted to read something, but I got diverted from that purpose and went elsewhere. So there are the ambition in terms of, you know, whatever talents we have, trying to do justice to the talents and being constructively engaged in our life, that is fine. But dissatisfaction comes not so much because I have not achieved what I want to achieve. It's possible that could be one reason for dissatisfaction. But dissatisfaction also comes because of the hundreds of other desires that are not even important for us. So, just as there are different forms of addiction. And alcoholism is one form of addiction. People can't resist the urge for alcohol. A far more prevalent form of addiction is shopaholism. Shopaholism is that people are compulsive shoppers. Shop, 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 shop till you drop. It's so many things. And many times, people shop, buy things which just from the shop, they go into their warehouse, they go into their basement or somewhere. They themselves even don't see it, don't use it. Now what has happened over here? They may have gone to shopping to do some particular things which they needed, but they also ended up taking a lot of other things. So there are certain desires which are important for us. And along with that, there are many other desires that are not important things. And we often get distracted from important things by other desires. So, in our life, if we have to achieve something, we need some ambition for that. And that ambition will drive us. But along with the main desires of our life, whatever it is that we ought to achieve, there are 100 other desires that come up and they consume our consciousness. They cause dissatisfaction. So dissatisfaction and ambition don't have to be contradictory, because dissatisfaction is often caused by the unfulfillment of peripheral desires. I see someone who has maybe a better gadget than what I have, or a better car than what I have, and I start feeling dissatisfied. Actually, there's nothing wrong with my gadget or my car, but just because I saw that, then I started dissatisfied. There's a difference between what we live with and what we live for. What we live with are the tools that we are using, the things which we need for surviving this world. What we live for is the purpose for which we live in this world. So quite often, if we are not careful about choosing our desires, what we live with becomes what we live for. That means money is important in life, but money is meant for a purpose. But sometimes money itself becomes the end. So people think that my self-worth is defined by my net worth. If I'm not earning more than that person, then I'm a failure. No, it doesn't have to be defined like that. Money is important, but we have purposes in our life. Money is a tool. Money is not the end in itself. So if you're not careful in choosing our desires, then we become driven by desires that are not very important for us. And such desires, they not only drive us, but they keep us dissatisfied. So the Bhagavad Gita explains that at our core, we are souls, we are spiritual beings. And the soul exists in this world for a purpose. The purpose
it's 3:30.
Is ultimately to connect with God. God is the source of the supreme satisfaction. He is a reservoir of happiness. And to the extent we become connected with Him, in love, to that extent, satisfaction streams into our heart. Satisfaction and joy, they enrich us. And that depends not so much on the things that we have around us. It depends on how much we are internally connected with God. Sukhena brahma samsparsham atyantam sukhamashnute. In the 6th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna talks about when we come in contact with spiritual reality, when we come in contact with God, brahma samsparsham. What happens at that time? Sukhena brahma samsparsham atyantam sukham. It's the ultimate happiness. That ultimate happiness, the satisfaction that can provide us is oceanic. It's like an ocean. The Bhagavad Gita acknowledges that there are many attractive things in this world. It does not tell us that whatever we find attractive in this world is all false. It tells us this: the attractiveness of these things is actually just a spark of Krishna's attractiveness. God has many different names in different traditions. The Bhagavad Gita knows him by the name Krishna. And in the 10th chapter, 41st verse, the Gita says, Yadyad vibhuti mat sattvam shrimad urjitam evava tattad eva avagachyattvam mama tejo amshasambhava. That all attractive things, whatever it is that is attractive, its attractiveness comes from a spark of Krishna's all attractiveness. So if a house looks very attractive to me, if a gadget looks very attractive to me, a person looks very attractive to you. Yes, they are attractive. But their attractiveness is just a spark of God's Krishna's attractiveness. And it's like if I'm cold, a spark, how much warmth can it provide me? If I go to the full fire, the fire can actually give me warmth. The spark cannot give me much warmth. So similarly, the attractive things of this world, they can give us some pleasure. But they are like sparks. And because they are like sparks, the pleasure that we get from them, it doesn't last for long. It doesn't last for long. So, relationships are now becoming increasingly turbulent. So, a lot of psychologists now study relationships. And they try to find out what can make relationships work. So, the more or less unanimous opinion among psychologists now is that romance has a shelf life of between 12 to 18 months. That means that when say one person meets another person and they fall in love with each other, when that happens, there is that feeling of attractiveness, and that attractiveness comes because certain hormones are triggered in the body when somebody looks very attractive or feels this person very attractive, and then in the presence of that person we feel very attractive, we feel thrilled. But that hormone secretion, it doesn't last for long. It lasts for a few months. And after a few months, what happens is, once the attraction subsides, then, initially, people say, I can't live without you. Afterwards, they say, I can't live with you. So there may be some attraction initially. So there may be love at first sight. Yes, there may be love at first sight, but actually the relationship will be determined not by whether there is love at first sight or not, but what is there after many sights. So the newness of things, that alone cannot give us satisfaction. So initially there will be attraction, but relationships are based not just on attraction, they're based on commitment. That sometimes there will be attraction, sometimes there will not be attraction. But only when there is commitment, the relationship becomes sustainable. And commitment means that even when there is no attraction, I still stay committed to the relationship. So the point I'm making is that there are attractive things in this world, and those attractive things can create feelings of pleasure. But they are, those attractive things are like sparks. And the spark, it says it can give only a little warmth. So similarly, the pleasure that we can get by getting newer and newer, better and better attractive things, that pleasure doesn't last for long. The human heart longs for lasting fulfillment. And that lasting fulfillment can be found when we direct our heart towards Krishna. So when we learn to love Krishna, when we connect lovingly with Krishna, that is when our heart's longing for lasting satisfaction will be fulfilled. It's connecting with a not just a big fire, we are connecting with the sun. So much warmth will be there, we'll be fully satisfied. Another example we could take to illustrate this difference in scale, like Krishna is like the ocean of happiness, and the objects of this world, they are like drops of happiness. So the drop can also give me some quenching of my thirst. But how much? Very little. That's why now I started this talk with things and thoughts. So I talked about how we want newer and newer things, and I think that will make me happy. There's a things will produce certain thoughts. Yeah, I got this, I feel good. But that feel good feeling will not last for long. For it to last for long, actually, we need to not just get better things in our life. We need to cultivate better thoughts. And the best thought that we can cultivate is the thought of Krishna. The Bhagavad Gita tells us one of its consistent recommendations is that we try to think of Krishna constantly. The more we think about him, the more we will become satisfied internally. Or this thinking of Krishna is not an abstract or merely internalized activity. Oh, I just sit and think of Krishna. No. Krishna, that means, what do I think of? No, okay, I see a beautiful form of Krishna. I think about that form. Okay, that's one way I can think of Krishna. But there are... Krishna doesn't just exist beyond this world. Krishna pervades this whole world. He pervades this whole world. That means we can serve him through the various activities in this world. Yataha pravrittir bhutanam yena sarvam idam kritam swakarmanatam abhyarcha siddhim vindati manava. So Krishna says, yataha pravrittir bhutanam, that absolute truth from whom everything has come. And yena sarvam idam kritam, by whom this whole world is pervaded. Swakarmanatam abhyarcha, by your work worship. And then by this, siddhim vindati manava, we will attain perfection. We will attain full satisfaction if we do this. So now it's saying basically, we can worship God through our work. Sometimes this is translated as work is worship. As the people say, Bhagavad Gita teaches the work, that work is worship. You know, work is worship. As an ethical principle for talking about the dignity of all labor, that is fine. But work is worship is not a philosophical principle. It's not the teaching of the Bhagavad Gita. If work itself were worship, then the donkey would be the greatest worship. If work itself were worship, you know, a thief may say, okay, my work is to rob. I'm worshipping by robbing. A beggar may say, my work is begging. I'm worshipping by begging. No, we can't say uncritically that all work is worship. And the Gita is not telling work is worship. What the Gita tells is, Swakarmanatam abhyarcha. It says, by your work, worship. It's not that automatically work itself is worship. But work is a means by which you can worship the Lord. And how we can worship the Lord? For that, the previous two lines of the verse say that God doesn't just exist beyond this world in his own abode. He is the source of this world and he pervades this world. So,
That means that one day we can understand this import of worshipping God with our work is that what we are is God's blessing to us. What we are is God's gift to us. What we become is our gift to God. What we are, whatever talents we have, whatever abilities we have, whatever resources we have, that is God's gift to us. Using them, what we become, that is our gift to God. So we are meant to use our talents, we are meant to use our abilities in a mood of service, in a mood of contribution. We all can play some part in making things better. Making not just our own life better, but making lives of those we love better. We use whatever abilities we have in a mood of service. So we see the talents that we have, we see the things that we have as gifts from God. So if I think those things alone will make me happy, then yes, I'll get some pleasure, but the pleasure will not last for long. And I'll want more and more things. But if I see those things as means for reciprocation of love and service, okay, I have certain things, they're God's gift to me. Let me use them in a mood of service. Then those things will connect us with God. Our work can be done in a spirit of worship. And then through our work also we can connect with God. And thus, while we are contributing in this world, you know, while we are working in this world, according to our talents, according to our abilities, we can also be going closer to Krishna. And thus, we can, while working in this world also, move toward higher spiritual fulfillment. But to do that, it is important that we recognize that we need time for directly connecting with Krishna. When we are doing our work, and we may do it in the mood of devotion, that is good. But at the same time, if we are not directly connecting with Krishna, directly connecting with Krishna means, you know, coming to the temple, doing kirtans, associating with devotees, studying scriptures like the Bhagavad Gita, studying books of wisdom. If you're not doing this activity, then our intention to serve Krishna will not be sustained. And that's where I'll talk about the triangularity of desires. Normally we think of desires as linear. You know, I see some object, say I'm going along a road, and I see some hotel where there's some food advertised. Okay, I want to eat that. So that's a linear desire. I'm here, that food item is here. I see that food item and I get the desire. So this is how desires are linear. But quite often, all desires are not necessarily linear. Desires are often triangular. Triangular means what? We may see a particular object, but we may or may not desire that object. But if we see someone else who is enjoying that object, then seeing that, hey, I also want to do that. Say, maybe a few months ago, this new video game, Pokemon Go, came out. So now, initially, it's just a new video game. And maybe somebody has not heard about that video game. And there's a big buzz about this game. Say, what's so great about it? Oh, it's just another new video game. But then they actually see somebody who is just clicking away, trying to catch some Pokemons here and there. Lost in their own world. Hey, what is this? What is so special about it? And then by seeing that person playing that game, I also want to try it. And then once they start playing it, they also get lost in that world. So here what has happened? Just hearing about that game did not create so much desire. The desire was not linear, but the desire was triangular. I saw that game, but then afterwards I saw someone who was playing that game. And by seeing someone playing that game, I got the desire. So the desire was triangular between me, the game, and somebody already playing that game. And many of our desires are triangular. In fact, the whole advertising industry, it doesn't just show people enjoying objects. It doesn't just show objects in abstraction. It shows good-looking people, famous people enjoying those objects. And because we are attracted to those people, we purchase the objects. Many of the, say, today's world sports stars or movie stars, once they become famous, they earn more through endorsements than to their main profession. They're sports, but sports doesn't give them so much money as if they promote a particular product. So what happens? When they start promoting a product, people think, oh, no, maybe I can,
If he's using that, she's using that. Maybe by using that, I'll become like that. And we become attracted to that object, and that's how the desire comes. So the desire is not just linear, it is triangular. Our desires, when we see people enjoying a particular object, then we get that desire. So, in India, I saw a particular and one advertisement of a Bollywood star. You know, this young man was walking along the road, and then there was a bevy of girls walking on the opposite, and they were not noticing him at all. And suddenly this Bollywood star came, and they all started squealing and running to that Bollywood star, hugging him, kissing him. And this young man was sorry for himself. Nobody noticed him. And then that Bollywood star comes out and he tells this.
It's 3:45.
By Shoran, do you want to know my secret? It's what? He says, my secret is this shampoo. And the shampoo. Oh, really? Then this boy goes and puts on the shampoo. And then walking along the road. And those girls see him and they start squealing and they run to him and start hugging him and kissing him. Now, such an advertisement actually is an insult to both male and female intelligence. You know that a girl will fall for a boy just because he has put some shampoo. That's an insult to female intelligence. And that a boy will believe fairy tales like this. That's an insult to male intelligence. But what is happening here? The emotions are so strong, the identification, emotional identification is so strong, the emotional current is so forceful, that intelligence is abandoned over you. Oh, I just want to become like that. I want to become so attractive. And therefore, again, the desire is, I may see that shampoo, I may not get attracted. Oh, this one star uses this. Oh, I want to get it. So our desires are not just linear, they are trying. And this triangularity of desires, it can be used against us when others induce unhealthy, unnecessary desires within us. But that same triangularity of desires can be used for our own growth. If we want to nourish desires that we know are good for us. For example, if I decide that, I know meditation is good for me. But somehow, I'm not able to make time for meditation. I don't get the inspiration, I don't get the mood, or I just don't make the time. So now we may say meditation, okay, it's a good activity. Or I may say I want to read. I heard Bhagavad Gita is a great book of wisdom. I want to read it. But somehow we're not able to make time for it. Now what happens here? We are there and the object is there. See, the object may be meditation, it may be studying a book of wisdom. But the desire doesn't come. Or desire is not sustained. However, so the linearly with spiritual objects, if you just have a linear between I and an object, the desire is often not very sustainable. It comes, it goes. But if we associate with devotees who have that desire strong, so if I associate with someone who is deeply in the study of the Bhagavad Gita. They read the same book and they get so much wisdom from it, so much insights. How do they do that? When we see them reading the Bhagavad Gita regularly, eagerly, and sharing wisdom from it, there must be something in this book. Let me also read it. So by associating with them, by seeing their desire, our desire becomes stronger. Same way, we may try to do say mantra meditation. We may come in. We may say, I want to do kirtans. Or I want to sing the holy. Singing is nice. Sometimes I do it, sometimes I don't do it. But if I come in the association of devotees, and I see devotees absorbed in singing, and so absorbed, so delightful. See, now I also want to get absorbed. I want to see what is there in this. I want to experience this. So, the spiritual experiences that we seek in our life, experiences of higher happiness, of higher reality, they can either be simply experiences that come and go, or they can be experiences that lead to a lasting transformation. And whether they will just be experiences that come and go, they'll be like blips in the horizon of our life experience, are there any significant alterations which change the trajectory of our life and help us to become better people? Help us to move towards the purpose of life, ultimately. As I said, the purpose of life, ultimately, is to connect with God. Because in that connection with God, we get the supreme happiness. So whether that spiritual experience just remains one spike on my life experience, or it changes my life trajectory, that depends on how regularly I associate with devotees. I associate with devotees regularly, then that association actually helps me to tap the triangularity of desires. Because when I come in the association of devotees, I see them practicing bhakti. Seeing their practice of bhakti, my desire to practice bhakti becomes stronger. And that's why association of devotees is association of spiritually minded people. That the important thing in that is the spiritual component. When we come to a temple is not meant to be just a nice social community. As it should be a nice social community, but it's not just that. It's a spiritual community. It's a community where God is at the center. Where we come and discuss about Krishna, we hear about Krishna, we learn about Krishna, and our desire to connect with Krishna becomes stronger and stronger. And even in the association of devotees, we can respect all devotees. But at the same time, we can look at even one or two devotees with whom we connect nicely. We can find that even few devotees in a handful, the one or two devotees we find with whom we can connect in the way they think, it makes sense to me. Then what happens? That will become a lasting spiritual connection for us. Yeah, they become our friends, they become our, if they are seasoned practitioners, they will become our mentors. And with their guidance, with their association, we can move onward smoothly in our life. So the facility for regular association, if we have that, then that, if we tap it, we will move onwards in our life. The Bhagavad Gita in 2.62 says, Sangha Sanjayate Kamaha. The word Sangha has multiple meanings. One meaning of the word Sangha is association. Sangha Sanjayate Kamaha means, in association, desires develop. The kind of association we keep, accordingly, our desires will develop. So I'll conclude with one point that actually many of us make resolutions. There was a survey done that 90% of people's New Year resolutions are not meeting. That means they made the same resolution last year and they couldn't sustain it. So this year they are again making the same resolution. So the New Year resolutions, they are not new because they are not able to sustain those resolutions. What happens over here? Why are we not able to sustain the resolutions? We may say, I just don't have strong willpower. I am a weak-willed person. I don't have determination. Yes, that may be true to some extent, but that is not the only factor. We have to understand that thoughts are also things. And when they are things, that means that they will naturally flow in a particular direction. So, if say this floor is inclined slightly in this direction, the floor is slightly inclined in this direction, then if I pour some water on the floor, then the water will naturally flow in this direction. Now, I can push it in that direction, but for that I have to make conscious effort. I have to maybe get something and push it up, then it will go in that direction. But if I leave it to itself, because of the inclination of the floor, the water will naturally flow in that direction. So this particular flow of water in a particular direction, because of the inclination of the floor, this is something which you can easily understand. But the same applies to our mental inclinations. Inclination often we use when it comes to mental, this realm, we talk about, I like something, I have an inclination for that. But that inclination, if you understand that, it's not just not just something, it's a thought in my mind. It's actually the way my mental architecture is shaped. So if say I decide the water is spilling this way, I won't let the water spill this way. Well, my decision that I won't let the water spill this way, that is not changing the inclination. Even if I say I don't want the water to flow this way, still the water is going to flow that way. So if I don't want the water to flow that way, actually I have to make some tangible changes. I may have to reshape the floor by which the side of the floor is higher and the inclination is changed. So changing the flow of water is not just a matter of intention. That intention has to be translated into tangible action. A tangible action can be either one thing is I repeatedly push the water in the opposite direction whenever it spills, or I reshape the architecture. I change the flooring direction so that the inclination is changed. Same way, sometimes we may decide, hey, I'm not going to do this, or I'm going to do this. We make a resolution. The resolution is good. That resolution is like saying, okay, my thoughts go in this direction, I want my thoughts to go in this direction. But you have to understand that if we have been repeatedly thinking in a particular way, then that has formed an inclination inside us. We would conceive of an inclination as a, say, the tilt in the floor of our mind. The mind is also a thing. So because it is a thing, that particular naturally thoughts will flow in that direction. So just by intention, we cannot have transformation. Intention is the beginning. Yes, the water is flowing this way. I don't want it to flow this way. That intention is important. But the intention alone is not enough for transformation. Along with the intention, there has to be a process. Process, okay, maybe I raise this floor on this side, decrease the floor on that side. I have to make some tangible change for that intention to actually be executed. The same way, maybe have some intention, okay, no, I understood that this Krishna Bhakti makes a lot of sense. I want to practice it. I like this Bhakti Yoga. But just that intention alone is not enough. That intention has to be coupled with a process. And the process of Bhakti Yoga itself, it helps in changing our mental architecture. What does it mean, changing our mental architecture? That means that if we repeatedly do a particular activity, then by repeatedly doing a particular activity, our default settings within the mind get changed. So right now, say my inclination maybe, I always see the thing that I don't have and I feel dissatisfied. I make a resolution. I will look at what I have and I will try to cultivate satisfaction. That's a good resolution. But that resolution alone is not enough. That resolution has to be coupled with the process. So, that process has external components to it. If we associate with people who are living simple lives and are satisfied with simple living. And there are some people who are simple living and high thinking. There are many other people who are simply living and hardly thinking. I know, whatever. Oh, buy this. Yes, yes, I want to buy this. I want to buy this. I want to buy this. Actually, they are living largely directed by the world. Get this, get this. That's not really living. They're basically almost like enslaved by the world. Buy this, enjoy this, eat this, go here. That's not really living. They're not really thinking about what is truly important for me. What is going to satisfy me. So when we choose our desires, for choosing our desires, again, association is important. So the more we associate with spiritually minded people, people who are who recognize that simple living and high thinking is what is good for me. When we live with people like that, then we also can cultivate that kind of inclination more easily. And further, when we start practicing Bhakti Yoga, so when we chant the names of Krishna, we associate with devotees, when we study scripture, by repeatedly doing this, the thought pattern gets changed. The thought pattern gets changed means the inclination is in one way, that inclination itself will change. But the change of inclination requires a process. So in the 12th chapter, 9th verse, the Bhagavad Krishna says, Atha chittam samadhatum na shaknosi maistiram abhyasa yogena tato mamichaptam dhananjaya. It says, if you are not satisfied in thinking of me, if you don't get samadhan, if you cannot think of me constantly, if you are not satisfied in thinking of me, what does he say? It's abhyasa. Abhyasa means practice. Still strive to fix your mind. Abhyasa yogena tato mam ichchaptum dhananjaya. By this abhyasa, by this practice, your desire for me will become stronger. So that means Krishna is telling here that don't just depend on your desires. Determine your desires. Sometimes people say that, oh, I don't have a desire to do this, so I won't do it. Don't just depend on your desire. One says cultivate the desire. So by doing spiritual activities as a discipline, our desire itself will become stronger. So we may have a little desire for becoming more spiritual, which is good. And if we associate with devotees, if we practice bhakti yoga, then that desire itself will become stronger. So that desire, that change of desire, that generation of new desires, generation of higher spiritual desires, that is like change of the inner architecture. And that happens by the process of bhakti yoga. So the intention has to be coupled with a process. And that will lead to lasting transformation. That will lead to the redirection of our life in a way that there will be greater fulfillment. Because the more we connect with Krishna, we may have many things, we may have few things, but we will be satisfied. And if we're not connected with Krishna,
4 o'clock.
No matter how many things we have, we will not be satisfied. Because the mental inclination will be such that no matter how much I have, I'll be looking at what I don't have. And that will cause dissatisfaction. But when we are connected with Krishna, we are looking at Krishna, whatever we have, we use in service, and that will bring us satisfaction. He may give us a lot more, and we can use that more also in Krishna's service. But what will bring us satisfaction is not what I have, but what I do with what I have. When I have a constructive purpose for using what I have in a mood of service and contribution, that will bring lasting satisfaction. I'll summarize and then we can have comments and questions. So I spoke about tapping the triangularity of our desires. And then I talked about how we all choose our things very carefully. Now, I want to get this device, I want to get this house, I want to get this dress. We choose our things very carefully and we think that by getting better things, I'll become happy. But actually, our happiness is determined much more by our thoughts than our things. And although there's a correlation between thoughts and things, the two are not necessarily one-to-one correspondence. I may have very good things, but still I may be dissatisfied. So maybe people may be comfortably miserable. They have a lot of comforts, but if they're constantly looking at all the things that they don't have, they'll be dissatisfied. Satisfaction is not just an emotion, it is also a decision. If I focus on looking at the things I have instead of the things I don't have, I can become satisfied. Like if I look at the feast that is there on my plate and savor it, instead of looking at what all delicacies are there on others' plates, then I can become satisfied. And satisfaction and ambition are not contradictory. We may have ambition for making some contribution in life, using our talents properly. But along with that, yes, that we can certainly do. But along with that, there are many peripheral desires that come into us. Superficial desires that are injected by the world into us. And we get distracted from our main contribution to all these superficial desires. And not having those desires, often not having the fulfillment of those desires, that's what often causes the dissatisfaction. So what we live for and what we live with are different. But if you're not careful, then what we live with becomes what we live for. And that is the path of perpetuating dissatisfaction. Because we can never have everything in this world. Whatever we have, there will always be new things that come up. So our mind itself has the habit of looking at the things we don't have. And the world also specializes with the advertising industry in showing us all the things we don't have. And thus we end up perpetually dissatisfied. So we need to choose our desires. We need to watch our thoughts and change our thoughts. And in that connection, I talked about the triangularity of desires. If I change my desires, I have to understand how desires develop. So thoughts and desires are connected. Desires are basically slightly stronger versions of thoughts. When I think about something, it becomes a desire over a period of time. So our desires are not just linear. I see an object and desire it, but they are also triangular. I see the object, I see someone else enjoying that object, and then I get the desire for that object. It's like a new video game or celebrities endorsing some products. But this triangularity of desires we can channel in cultivating higher spiritual desires. So actually, why should we cultivate higher spiritual desires? Because the highest spiritual reality, Krishna, he is the source of unlimited happiness. Whatever pleasure we get in the things of this world, that's like a spark or like a drop. Whereas Krishna is like the full ocean.
And that's why if we just change the things of the world, we get a little pleasure, but after that, the pleasure then disappears. The newness of new objects doesn't last for long. I can't live without you becomes I can't live. Romance has a shelf life of a few months. So why? Because it's just a drop. So if we connect with Krishna, that's like connecting with the ocean, that will give us lasting satisfaction. And to connect with Krishna, again, the triangularity of desire. So just be where I hear the holy name, we see the picture of Krishna, we may look at the Bhagavatam, we may feel some attraction. But if we associate with those who are attracted to these things, then say, oh, they get so much wisdom from the Gita. I want to read it. They get so much taste in this. My use is Kirtan. I want to read the Kirtan. And that way, we can sustain our practice of bhakti by associating regularly with those who are having strong desires for practicing. And when we want to make a transformation in our life, it's not just a matter of resolution. It's like the water, the floor is inclined in a particular way. There's a resolution is not enough. We have to couple that resolution with the process. We have to reject the surface inclination. Then the water will flow in another direction. Like that, our thoughts are presently inclined to go in a particular direction. So if you want to change that, if I'm habitually looking at the things that I don't have anything to satisfy, just changing that is not just a matter of making an intention. It also has to be a process. If you associate with those who are more living simple living, and practicing simple living and hiding, I feel inspired to practice that. And further, we cultivate devotional desires by exposing ourselves to Krishna. Rather than we letting our desires determine our life, we determine our desires. We choose which desires I want to cultivate. And by exposing ourselves to Krishna more and more, as a systematic discipline, as a disciplined practice, our attraction to Krishna will increase. And then the inclination of our mind will change. And then naturally, the more we will become, just as naturally we will be attracted to worldly objects now, we will become naturally attracted to Krishna. And in that natural attraction to Krishna, there is perennial satisfaction. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
So, any questions? Yes, please.
Thanks, Prabhu. You mentioned about you get desire from associating with spiritually minded people who have desire. I'm just wondering, I'm in a critical mind myself, you may not have, is that devotee expected to be perfect before we take shelter of that person? Or is it maybe have strong points in certain areas and we can learn from that? So, where do you go?
Thank you. So, when we associate with devotees and forget spiritual desires, who does devotees have to be? Does it have to be perfect? Actually, we have to understand what perfection means. The perfection of a devotee is their perfect intention to serve Krishna. They have no selfish desires. That is for pure devotees. And along with that, other devotees also may have stronger desire for Krishna than what we have. So, we don't necessarily have to go on a critical evaluation of every devotee to find out at what level of spiritual advancement they are. If they are they have a stronger desire for Krishna than us, if by their association our spiritual desire gets strengthened, then that is good enough for us. So, rather than when we start evaluating other devotees, we go into a very subjective and possibly offensive zone. How do I know who is a pure devotee or who is perfect? It's very difficult for me to know that. It takes one to know one. So, what I can see is, what is the effect of this devotee's association on me? So, inspiration can never be legislated. I may find one devotee inspiring, you may find another devotee inspiring. So, we can look at if by associating with them, by hearing from them, by seeing them in action, if we feel inspired, yes, this is what I want to do. I want to serve Krishna. I want to love Krishna. I want to do these activities. Then we can focus on that effect on us. And by seeing that effect, if that is positive, if that uplifts us, inspires, energizes us in our bhakti, then we can associate with those devotees more. Does that answer your question? Thank you. Any other questions? Sure. Yeah, please. Great.
Thank you, Prabhu. It was very enlightening.
Thank you.
So you said that satisfaction and ambition, they're not contradictory.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's very difficult to, especially in a spiritual level, to isolate where your ambition is just an expansion of your ego or your mental space. How do you expand on how they are not contradictory? How to be satisfied and yet be ambitious in the spiritual life?
Okay. Are you talking specifically about spiritual life, or are you talking about material life?
Spiritual.
Okay. So, how can we be satisfied and still be ambitious in spiritual life? Yes, as I said, if we see our talents as gifts from Krishna, then Krishna has given us certain gifts, and we are meant to use them in the service. Even the most talented person, they may have certain skills, but actually, they had to practice to develop those skills. Now, Arjuna, it was not that he just became a champion archer. Not that he was born from the womb with a bow and arrow in his hands. And he was shooting arrows perfectly. He practiced rigorously. When the Mahabharata describes that, you know, all day he would be learning and night practically, most of the night he would practice. That's why one of his names is Gudakesh, one who has conquered sleep. He would stay awake and he would practice. The story goes that once after a day of practice, he had come to the Gurukul where he was staying. And at that time, because of a gust of wind, the lamp went off. At that time, he was eating food. And then, when the lamp went off, he found his hand properly went to the food and then went to his mouth. And he said, if I can eat in the absence of light, why can't I shoot in the absence of light? And then he started practicing at night to hit targets just based on their sound. And that capacity to hit invisible targets, that proved decisive or critical in his eventually serving Krishna in the Kurukshetra war. So Arjuna also worked hard to develop his archery skills. So if we have certain abilities, to develop those abilities, it is actually a service to Krishna. So if we see it in that mood, there are certain abilities I have, certain resources I have, and in order to use them constructively, I have to practice. I have to work at them. So then that aspiration is not necessarily a selfish ambition. It can be an ambition for serving Krishna. Now at this stage in our spiritual life, our desires will never be purely selfless. There will be some desire to glorify Krishna. There will be some desire to, yes, I also want to be praised. I also want to be appreciated. So we can't postpone our service till we become pure. Because service is the means to become pure. So, once there was a devotee who used to sing kirtans very nicely. And he was singing kirtan and Prabhupada came to the temple hall. And when Prabhupada came there, Prabhupada took darshan and went out. While going out, Prabhupada came, your kirtan is very nice. Foreign, this was perfection. Prabhupada, spiritual master, has praised and appreciated his kirtan. Then he thought, I may not get my association of my spiritual master once again. He asked, but Prabhupada, sometimes I feel proud. And then Prabhupada just patted him on the back. What's wrong with that? What's wrong with that? And he walked away. Now he said, pride is one of the gates to hell. How can Prabhupada say, what's wrong with that? Krishna says, last anger, so not one of the gates to hell, it's one of the six anarthas. So, how can I say there's nothing wrong with it? Actually speaking, pride is already there within us. If I think that, if I do this service, if I develop this talent, I will become proud. Then, that is an illusion. Because I am thinking I am not proud right now. So, it's something like lust. Now sometimes you may say, exposure to a particular scene, particular object may make me lust. But actually it is not that object is causing lust. Actually the lust is present within our heart and that object triggers lust. Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, that lust is not present in, lust is present in the body, in the senses, the mind, and the intelligence. Indriyani mano buddhi rasya adhishthana uchyate. So, the external object is not the source of the lust. The external object is the trigger of the lust. So, the lust is present inside me only, and it gets triggered by seeing certain sights. Like that, pride is there inside me only, but say right now, there is pride inside me, but I have nothing to be proud of right now. So in the future, when I do something special, I'll have a reason to be proud of. But it's not that is when I am becoming proud. Pride is already there within me, but at that time I am expressing the pride. Right now I have no reason to express the pride. So, the way to becoming free from pride is not suppression of talent. If I say I have some talent, if I use that talent, I'll become proud. If I think like that, and so I don't use the talent, then what is going to happen?
It's 4:15.
I may think I will not become proud, but that pride will come off in an ugly form as envy. You know, if I have ability to sing, but I don't sing nicely, I think I become proud. Then somebody else sings nicely and people praise them. So proud. Such a show off. So that same pride which is inside me is now coming off as envy for some other person. So what we do is, in the process of bhakti, whatever abilities we have, we use them in Krishna's service. And there may be some desire within me to be praised, to be appreciated. But if I keep doing the service, gradually I'll start realizing, okay, I sing for Krishna, and then afterwards, after I finish the kirtan, you know, I see who all is going to come and praise me. Oh, kirtan is so nice. But that may happen like that. You know, before I was introduced to bhakti, I had a desire to be a public speaker. And I used to participate in elocution competitions and things like that. Now, after I started practicing bhakti, after a few years, I started giving classes. So initially, I was very conscious, you know, after the class, how many people come and praise me? And one time, I gave a very good class. At least I thought it was a very good class.
I had prepared very well.
And all the thoughts were flowing nicely. I spoke very fluently. And I was absorbed in the class. But at the end of the class, nobody gave an appreciation. So initially, I was a little frustrated. But then it struck me at that time, actually, while speaking about Krishna, I was so absorbed. I was so satisfied. So, the satisfaction through absorption in Krishna is greater than whatever satisfaction may come from praise by others. Now, that realization I would not have got if I had never given classes. That means when we are doing service, there is a Krishna connection that gives us satisfaction and there is the worldly appreciation that gives satisfaction. But when we keep doing that service regularly, gradually we realize that the Krishna connection gives greater satisfaction than the worldly appreciation. And then the desire for the worldly appreciation goes down. So that's how the cure for pride is not suppression of talent. The cure for pride is purification of intent. It's purification of intent. Initially I do service because I want to be praised by others. But anyway, whatever it is, start doing the service. And if we keep doing the service, we get a taste for connection with Krishna. And by the taste for connection with Krishna, we will purify our intent. Now, even if I get it, I don't get it. But connection with Krishna is what I want. And that way, we can become free from pride. So, as far as ambition is concerned, you know, if we have a particular talent, if we have a desire to serve in a particular way, we can take the blessings of senior devotees around us and develop that talent wholeheartedly. And if sometimes, you know, we are becoming too proud, we senior devotees will tell us, this is becoming too much. You know, if I am singing kirtans very nicely, and then every time somebody else sings kirtan, you know, hey, he's doing that wrong. There's one devotee who said, you know, I was in a temple long ago, so he said, you know, in this temple, this devotee had learned all ragas very nicely. And he said, in this temple, nobody knows how to sing. Therefore, I alone should be doing all the kirtans. Now, that pride going to a little obnoxious level. So that has to be avoided. So then senior devotees will tell you, you don't think that music is what, we are not doing a musical performance here. We are doing devotional service here. So we have to see devotional intention. There may be some devotees who will be very good at music. But don't forget that you are not here just for music. You are here for serving Krishna. So if the pride becomes too much, devotees will tell us. But we should focus on trying to serve Krishna. And gradually we'll get that realization by which we'll become purified. And then we will serve Krishna for serving Krishna and pleasing Krishna, not for worldly appreciation. Does that answer your question? Thank you. Yes, please.
We may feel we're not inclined, for example. We have no real enthusiasm to do it. Should we still try to do it anyway? We may not have that much inclination or that much ability in that area.
Okay.
Is that also
purified? So if we don't have an inclination to do something, then should we still try to do it? And will that purify us?
It depends on what that activity is. Now, if it is a core devotional activity, just say chanting the holy names or studying scriptures, then that's a part of our essential purificatory process. And then we should do that. And by associating with other devotees who have a taste for that, we are trying to understand what is it that gives them so much taste. Then gradually we'll get that taste also over a period of time. So now, if it is not a core devotional activity, which is a part of our sadhana, if it is some other activity, maybe some service, some devotees do managerial service, some devotees do preaching service, some devotees do some other kinds of services. If I am not very comfortable with a particular service, then it is a balance between individual need and institutional need. Sometimes the temple where we are, they may need a particular service. So then we may do that service at that time. But over a period of time, for sustainable practice of bhakti, it is good that our primary service be something which we are inclined to do. Because we all have a swabhava. We all have a particular nature. That nature, we don't have, the Bhagavad Gita talks about Brahman, Kshatriya, Vaishya, Shudra. Now, that classification to four varanas may not be very practical in today's times. That's a whole different subject. But the underlying principle is, it's not just categorization into four categories. The principle is that there are different natures, that means different people have different things which they feel inspired to. And when they are engaged in that way, then they can move forward harmoniously in their life. So there are only two verses in the Bhagavad Gita that are repeated. Not verbatim, but almost verbatim. One is the call for a devotion to Krishna. Manmanabhav madbhakto madhyaji mamamaskuru. In 9.34 is Maam evaishyasi yuktvaiva maatmana matrayana. In 18.65 it is Maam evaishyasi satyam te pratijani priyosime. Just devote yourself to. Second verse that is repeated is Shreyan swadharmo viguna paradharma samushtipada. In 3.35 is Swadharme nidhanam shreya paradharmo bhayavaha. 18.46 is that Swabhava niyatam karma purvan naatmoti kimish. Krishna says, act according to your nature. Don't act according to others' nature. So, if there is something which we are not at all attracted to, if we feel a lot of resistance towards doing that internally, then maybe that is not our nature. So, as an expression of surrender, if we are told to do that, we may do that when it's a need. But for sustainability, if something causes too much resistance within us to do, then trying to do that we may say it may purify. But then the price is so much. See, we don't just want to be purified. We also need to be enlivened, to be encouraged in our bhakti. So what happens sometimes when we are working too much against our material nature? That incompatibility with our material nature causes dissatisfaction. And we mistake that dissatisfaction to be spiritual dissatisfaction. And we think, hey, this process of bhakti doesn't work. So it is actually not spiritual dissatisfaction, it is material dissatisfaction. Because of the incompatibility of what I am doing with my nature. So then when we mistake that material dissatisfaction to be spiritual dissatisfaction, then we may become disheartened in the practice of bhakti and give up the practice of bhaktis. That should not happen. Bhakti is connection with Krishna, and the connection with Krishna gives us higher satisfaction. And according to our nature, if we do services, then there is not so much incompatibility, not so much resistance inside us. And we can be fruitfully engaged materially. Does that answer your question? Thank you. Any other questions? Yes,
please. The mind knows that the practice of bhakti is at the highest level, and the mind knows that one can become happy by practicing bhakti. So the mind should do what is, what is happiest for it. But why is it so difficult for the mind to attain bhakti than the material?
So when the mind knows that bhakti will provide the highest happiness, why is still the mind attracted to material things rather than towards Krishna? The mind is a creature of habit, actually. So whatever it has done in the past, it just keeps doing that again and again and again. Almost, you can say the mind acts mindlessly. That means, there is actually an experiment done by a psychologist, Alexander Pavlov. It's called Pavlovian response. So he had, there's an experiment with some dogs. And whenever he provided food to those dogs, at that time, he would ring a bell. And gradually, what happened is, whenever he would ring a bell, the dogs would start salivating. Normally, they would salivate when they would see a food. But because the food was regularly associated with the ringing of the bell, their mind started associating not the sight of the food with sight of the food with saliva, but their mind started associating the sound of the bell with saliva. And afterwards, even when you would ring a bell and not provide food, still the dog would saliva. So like that, you know, certain things may have given us some pleasure in the past. But over a period of, so the mind associates that with pleasure. And then now, when we grow up spiritually, those things don't give us much taste. But still, because the mind is a creature of habit, so it just thinks this is pleasure. And it acts that way. So that's why I talk about the default setting. The default setting can't be changed automatically. It has to be changed conscientiously. So we need to use our intelligence. That means when the mind starts, I want to go in this direction, but the mind is going in that direction. Then I have to use my intelligence. Okay. No, it's going in this direction, but there's nothing over there. So let me bring it in this way. Yato yato nishcharati manas chanchalam astiram tatastato nyayayam atmanyayoshinayam. And 6.27 in the Bhagavad Gita says that wherever and whenever the mind wanders, bring it back under the control of the self. And by this, gradually what will happen? Yunjanayam atmanam yogi Sukhena Brahma Samisparsham Atyantam Sukhamashanti. The previous verse is 6.26, this is 6.27 actually. So Krishna says, by doing this repeatedly, mind will become pacified. It will become purified. And it will settle in the direction of Krishna. So one thing is, we need to know that it is going to require repeated bringing the mind back on Krishna. And second thing is, what we could do to make that thing easier, is if the mind goes in a particular wrong direction, then we minimize the access to that wrong direction. So for example, if I have a tendency to just spend a lot of time surfing on the internet, then I may decide that, okay, I may have some restricted access on the internet. I may have a net filter which allows only certain times, or only certain sites, or whatever. So what happens is, those desires, when they come, as a spike, sudden surge of desire. And at that time, it seems almost irresistible. But after a few minutes, if we succumb at that time, why did I do that? I didn't want to do that. What happened to me? So when that surge of desires comes, it becomes a little difficult to resist at that time. But the surge doesn't last for long. It will come, it will go. If we can just tolerate during that surge, then we will not succumb to it. So one way to tolerate during that surge is to not have the facility to act on the desire. So it can be with respect to anything. You know, some of us may be obese. So one of the things that obese people are told is that don't keep fatty food next to you. But all you are hungry, keep some healthy snacks next to you. Keep some salad, keep some fruits. So what happens by that? Even if the urge to eat comes, okay, I'm hungry. Then if there is a fatty food, immediately I take that. No matter how many resolutions I have made, I'm not going to eat this. But we eat it. But if it is not accessible, then
I have to maybe go there, go somewhere, buy it or cook it, and then purchase it. Well, I'm going to do all that. Oh, why am I doing this? I decide not to do that. Until this comes back. So it's good to decrease the access to a particular weakness or a particular indulgence to which the mind is habituated. And by that, we can decrease the chances of the mind going in that direction and increase the chances of the mind going towards Krishna. Does that answer your question? Is it a question? Yeah. Okay. Yeah, that's
fine. So, compared to satisfaction, because of affection, you mentioned appreciate what you've got and have a simple life. Is that correct? So, basically, I wanted to ask, is it not better to know what your minimum requirements are and then basically fulfill that in order to be satisfied?
How can we know? Is that what you're asking? How can we know what our...
Yeah, so rather than appreciating what you've got or what's been given to you, it's better to understand what your minimum requirements is.
It's 4:30.
Okay. So, instead of being satisfied with what we have, isn't it better to understand what our minimum requirements are and try to be satisfied with that?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, that's possible. Now, when you talk about minimum requirements, what will be minimum will also vary at different times in life.
So, for example, you buy a phone, for example, you know that the latest iPhone has similar features to the one from the previous year.
Can you speak a little loudly?
So, basically,
you slowly also.
Okay. So, if you buy an iPhone, for example, you know that today's one will be very, very similar to the one from last year and the year before that. So, as a minimum requirement, you know that the 2-year-old model would be sufficient because it has the camera, which actually has something you need on it, so you don't need the latest version.
Yeah.
So is it better to do that one?
Yeah. So, isn't it better to know what our needs are and then get those objects? And that way we can be satisfied instead of simply looking at what we have and trying to cultivate satisfaction. Yes, I think both are similar, both are different ways of approaching the same point. So, if we understand what our functional needs are, and then we can say, okay, I have this and this is enough. I don't need, I don't need a phone with 100 other features. Because this is what I need and this is what I have over here. So, with respect to a phone, it may be relatively easier to understand what my functional needs are. With some other objects, it may not be so easy to know. But it's like, it's something like appetite. Now, how much should I eat? Nobody else can tell me. Hey, if I'm taking chapatis, some people may need 3 chapatis, some people may need 6 chapatis. Some people may need 2 chapatis, whatever it is. So by our own experience, we come to know, hey, I've eaten too much now. I should have eaten less. Or, I ate too little. I should have eaten more. Now usually like eating too little doesn't happen very often. More often we eat too much. So, like that, we also learn through experience. So how much is the right appetite for me? I learn through experience. So in some cases, we can start from our need, this is what I need, and I'll move toward it. In some cases, understanding our need itself may require some experimentation. This is what actually I need. But I thought this was what I needed, but actually I need something more. Or I need something less. That we learn from experience. So it's very good to be able to fit our desires according to our needs, rather than letting our desires become our needs. Oh, I want this, and then if I don't have it, I will not be satisfied. But rather, I look at, start with what do I need, what is my functional need, and then we move forward from there. So either by thinking ourselves or by going by experimenting with a few things, we learn what our needs are, and then once we those needs are served, we'll be satisfied. Yes, that's a very sound strategy for cultivating satisfaction in our lives. Thank you.
Could you explain about desire and how it's not linear but the triangle? How do I explain that concept to a child? Because they're ones who are tempted with what the friends have quite easily. And how do I explain it in terms that a child can understand it?
Okay. how do we say explain the triangularity of desires to children? I think this is a concept that is learned, that is more caught than taught. Now, if there are other, say, devoted children or other children who are having a lot of things and enjoying those things, then our children also get the desire for that. But if there are other children who are really satisfied with lesser things, then they can see that. And these children, they don't have all these things, they're still happy. That's why it's good for, if they have a reasonably well-developed community, for devoted children to have some forum where they come together. Maybe it could be Sunday school. If the community is well developed, you can have a devotee school itself. But that may take a long amount of effort. But at least some forum where devotee children come together. And through that, they can actually all be spiritually nourished through the associated like-minded at their level. And in general, children are much more mind than intelligence. In fact, at a very small age, the babies are simply mind, they're no intelligence. Just act whatever they feel like. They feel like crying, start crying. So, as they grow, the intelligence starts developing. But, you know, we can also, the children will always be more mind than intelligence. But they do have intelligence. And if we actually, instead of talking down to them, we talk to them. You know, we also speak to their intelligence. And their intelligence also grows by that. They may not immediately appreciate that or act on that. But there is a side where they are driven by feelings, but they also have some intelligence. So if you take the time to explain things to them, we have to maybe stretch our brain to find out ways to explain in a way that is understandable for them. That may vary according to the particular child, the particular thing to be explained. But if we do that, if we nourish their intelligence, their intelligence will also grow. If we treat them simply as creatures of feelings, then that's how they will stay. Those feelings will become more and more demanding and less manageable. But if you understand, they also have mind, they also have feelings. The feelings will be much weaker right now. So for dealing with the feelings of the mind, we try to provide them some association of similar children who are maybe satisfied with simple things. And for also nourishing their intelligence, we explain things. They may not accept it immediately. See, when we are explaining things, quite often, we make the explanation a function of transformation. Or we make the explanation simply as a tool for transformation. That is, you know, now I've explained this, now your behavior should change. Things don't happen so immediately. Sometimes, just as far, even when we are grown up, sometimes some things they make sense intellectually, but we're not able to act on them. Just as that happens to us, it can happen to them also. So, but still, we take the time to explain things to them, and at least they're there somewhere in the back of their consciousness, and gradually it will come forward to the forefront and they'll act on it. So we can address them at the level of the mind and at the level of the intelligence. By giving appropriate association and giving appropriate explanation. And then gradually, they will also gravitate towards not craving for more and more. Does that answer your question? Any other questions?
During the talk, you mentioned that there are three parts to us, so there's the mind, body, and the soul.
Yeah.
But obviously, you mentioned that faults can happen in the body and the mind. So what would happen, obviously in these days there's a lot of problems with people being stressed or anxious or depression. So if we see those as faults in the mind, how would becoming more Krishna conscious actually benefit? Is there any studies done on this, or is there anything like, are people, you know, is there anything to actually say that, you know, people become less anxious or they become happier or
So, is there any evidence or explanation about how the practice of Krishna consciousness can decrease stress and increase happiness? Yes, at various levels. I'll start with first with generic religious spirituality, and then I'll come to specifically Krishna consciousness. There's a
book called Oxford, is published by Handbook of Religion and Health. It's published by the Oxford University Press. And that actually took 2,000 studies, which have been published studies done in various parts of the world, about the correlation between religious practice on one side and physical health parameters as well as mental health parameters on the other side. And they found a consistent correlation. Found that on average, that religious people who go to a religious program at least once a week, they live 7 years longer than those who don't go. So, just by coming once a week or Sunday, you are increasing your lifespan by 7 years. That's what these studies are saying. So long, and it's not just a matter of longevity being increased, but the quality of life. Found that elderly people who had personal faith, they had greater life satisfaction and sense of well-being than their non-religious peers. Younger people had lesser, say, drug addictions or drug abuse or premature sexual involvement or delinquency. They're much, much lesser. And Harold Cunning was a lead researcher in this compilation, and his conclusion was that he said a high SQ faithfulness to God benefits people of all ages, background, and educational levels. SQ refers to spiritual quotient. Just like we have IQ, intellectual quotient, EQ, emotional quotient. Like the SQ is spiritual quotient. So that's about broad practice of spirituality, practice of religious activities in general. There is well-documented studies which say that they improve the quality and the longevity of life. Now, coming specifically to Krishna consciousness, there was a study done about specific chanting of the Hare Krishna mantra. It was done by a researcher, Dr. David Brian Wolf, as a part of his PhD studies. And it was done at, was it, which university? Does anyone remember which university it was? Florida State University? Yeah. So basically, they subjected a number of people, three groups. One group chanted Hare Krishna, another group chanted any other sound that they like, and third group did not chant at all. And they found that this group, they were studied for a period of several months. They found that the people who were chanting Hare Krishna, their stress levels, their negativity levels, their depression levels, had substantially gone down. And this is a well-published study. So this is now if you see the Krishna consciousness movement it's been 50 years around. So there are not many devotee scientists or devotee researchers who are specialized enough to do studies like this. So in future, as more and more devotees become specialized in these fields, or people specialized in these fields become devotees, whichever way, then such studies will be done much more. But in general, in terms of philosophical explanation or analysis, you can say, what causes anxiety? Actually, I just gave a full seminar in Ohio State University on this anxiety epidemic. So I was explaining that worry is the interest we pay on loans we haven't yet taken. That means most of the things which we worry about, those problems are not yet happening. You know, I get a small ulcer on my body, I think, this may be cancer. And what if it is terminal cancer? What if it is advanced terminal cancer? Now, what if I have only 1 month to live? Well, it's nothing, just a small swelling on the body. From that, I have only 1 month to live, what will happen to me? So what will happen is, many times, when we worry, we take the situation that is there right now, and the uncontrolled mind shows us a horror movie based on that situation. And in this horror movie, you know, we are not the spectators, we are the victims. So it's all happening to us. So now, if you look at the situation that has caused anxiety, in any situation, there are some things which are in our control and some things which are not in our control. If I focus on the things that are in my control, that same situation can bring intensity. If I focus on the things that are not in my control, that will cause anxiety. Say if I have an interview tomorrow, and I start thinking, what kind of questions will come over there? What if I don't, what if I forget that? What if the examiner is in a bad mood? What if this, what if that? All this will cause anxiety. But if I think, okay, tomorrow's the interview, I have 24 hours. Let me plan my time in such a way that I can do the maximum revising, studying, remembering, so that I'll be fully prepared. Then that same situation can actually bring intensity. So now to shift our focus from what is not in my control to what is in my control. What is required? And one is, I could suggest, my determination to focus on what is in my control. What is in my control? But other aspect to it is spiritual understanding. Spirituality helps us to understand that that which is not in my control is not out of control. That which is not in my control is not out of control because it is in Krishna's control. So when I think, okay, these things are not in my control, but they are under Krishna's control. So Krishna will take care of those things. Let me focus on taking care of the things that are in my control. So when fear accelerates our imagination,
it's 4:45.
When fear accelerates our imagination, faith is the brake that stops that imagination from going haywire. When fear or anxiety starts accelerating, hey, what if that happens? What if that happens? Okay, those things are in Krishna's control. What is in my control? Let me do that. So our faith in Krishna increases. Faith is not just an abstract conception that God is in control. But actually, when you practice bhakti, Krishna becomes an inner experience, inner reality for us. We start experiencing Krishna as an inner reality. And the more Krishna becomes an inner reality for us, the more faith becomes natural. So, machitta sarvadurgan, matrasada, tanishas. Krishna says, if you become conscious of me, you'll pass over all obstacles by my grace. So that capacity to redirect our thoughts from the things not in our control to the things in our control, that capacity increases by the practice of bhakti. And thus, we can actually experience, if we practice bhakti, the anxiety levels will substantially go down. They will. In Hindi they say, chinta mat karo, chintan karo. Don't worry, contemplate. Contemplate emotion. And actually, if you do chintan, the chinta will go down. The anxiety, the stress will substantially go down if we learn to practice bhakti and focus on Krishna. Another thing that will happen is that when we start practicing spirituality, our inner territory becomes illumined. That means, say this room is dark completely, and the room is dark, the door opens, somebody comes in. I don't know who is it. Is it a friend? Is it an enemy? Is it a thief? I don't know. So I'll be worried. But if the light is on, I can see, okay, this person friend, welcome. This person, oh, a suspicious looking character, close the door. So we get discern that. So when we are not practicing spirituality, you know, our inner territory is in darkness. This thought comes up, that thought comes up. So we are not able to discern which thought is actually good for me, which thought is bad for me. Whatever thought comes in, we just start acting according to those thoughts. So quite often, we nourish stress-creating thoughts and stress-creating behaviors, unwittingly. But when we start practicing bhakti, then our inner territory becomes illumined. Start saying, okay, this thing I'm doing is causing me too much stress. And the returns I'm getting from this thing are not really that much. So maybe this I can postpone to later. So the capacity to discern and to arrive at a more healthy sense of balance, healthy sense of priorities in our life, that capacity also increases by spiritual practice. So both in terms of things not in our control, we can entrust the faith to Krishna. And things which are in our control, within that, what to focus? Do this, do that, what to focus? Because when our territory becomes clear, then we can make our priorities in a more healthy and balanced way. That's how, both from empirical evidence, as well as from conceptual analysis, can see that the practice of bhakti will help us to decrease our anxiety and stress substantially. Does that answer your question? Thank you. So, shall we stop here? So thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. 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 Jai.
Praise Chaitanya Charan Prabhu ki Jai!